Welcome to the Quintessential Listening Poetry Online Radio and YouTube Podcast, streamed live from the heart of Washington, D.C. Here, you'll find a portal to vibrant voices, echoing souls, and an ongoing celebration of the extraordinary power of language. So, prepare yourself to join host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram and his special guests as they explore traditional and spoken word forms of poetry.
In March 2024, Quintessential Listening Poetry Online Radio and YouTube Podcast hosted an event during Women's History Month dedicated to honoring the significant contributions of women poets. On Saturday, March 23rd, renowned poets Naomi Bindman, Mary Louise Kernan, and Amanda Russell captivated the audience with their powerful verses, highlighting the profound impact women have had in shaping the world of poetry. Naomi Bindman.
Hello, and thank you so much. I feel so honored to be invited to read with these fine poets. And thanks to all the folks who have tuned in. It's always so encouraging to see, in this case, your names. And so I just have to say, in terms of self-introduction, that I'm a bit of a late bloomer when it comes to being a poet. I've written poetry all my life, but only in the last 2 years have I begun to publish, except with one or two small exceptions. So the way I came to it was circuitous. Most of my career, I've been an educator who liked to write on the side. In 2009, my 17-year-old daughter lost her life in a car crash, and mine came to a stop. My journey back to life was through playing her music. She was a singer-songwriter. And then writing about it. And at some point, I realized, and I wrote a memoir that I'm now seeking publication for. At some point, I realized that the poems didn't belong in the memoir, and that should be their own separate thing. So I began working on a poetry manuscript. And the first poem I'm going to read is the first poem that got published separately, because I realized it didn't belong in the manuscript. It just doesn't fit with the rest of my work, but it fits with today very well, I think. And it came about because when I was playing Ellen's songs at different venues, my favorite venue is Cafe Lina in Saratoga Springs, New York, which is a family-friendly listening room and a very safe space. However, on one particular night, there was a performer who was antithetical to that, and I left. The feelings are in the poem. And so was the rhythm of his performance. So that carried over into this poem as well. It's called Rebuttal. It has some colorful language. You say you want your dick sucked. Wanna fuck the bitches and the hoes. You're talking about me, bro, when I say what I see, when I speak out about the words you choose, how you use my sisters, when I refuse to cower before your condemnation. Implicit intimidation, explicit degradation. And no, I am not just offended. And yes, I am just a little bit angry. Assaulted, insulted, pissed off, and fed up with the bullshit. I will not submit. I am sick of the attack. So you better backtrack. Take another tack, Jack. Examine the stack of lies that comprise your mind. Redesign your thinking, stinking with hostility and misogyny. Two can play this little word game, and I am not ashamed or as tame as you may believe. Looks can deceive, my words achieve power beyond shock value, shallow and hollow. I allow myself to be defiant, will not be silent or compliant, will not genuflect. I have self-respect, and my message is direct. You want pussy, motherfucker? Good luck. Go fuck yourself. So that got published in a feminist literary journal out of George Mason University called So to Speak. And now I'm going to rewind to the first poem that I ever published. It was after Ellen's death. I wrote it, though, when she was small. And this was in Mothering magazine. It's called Ode to My Daughter's Navel. I love my daughter's navel when she lifts her shirt to show me her belly full with pizza. It marks what remains of the place our lives momentarily flowed together, then separated. I pretend to admire her full belly, but marvel silently instead at the absent purple cord. And though soon she will be far too big for demonstrations of fullness, I join her games now. They will too soon be only memories. Anyhow, when I kiss her belly, I am remembering her birth. This poem I wrote two springs ago, and I think of it as a zip file of my life, 60 years compressed into 4 minutes, and it's called Senescence. Grandma, how old are you? She stops, faces me, states, I am 55 years old. I am 5, astonished by such a number. That's old, I exclaim, my eyes wide. If I'm so old, she offers me the vacuum cleaner, maybe you should do this. At 10, I wait for a bus beside a wilted man drooped over a white cane. I ask, and he tells me stories of dirt roads and trolley cars, meadows and woods where buildings now stand. Does he know he's old, I wonder? What does it feel like? At 29, I give birth. To my daughter, I am omniscient and omnipotent. To myself, I'm just trying to figure it all out. At 36, I am the age my mother lived to. My train of thought occasionally leaves without me. I tell this to my grandmother. Oh, Kuchki, she says, you're still just a baby. Each morning in the dappled woods, the cycle of birth and decay persists. A symphony of translucent greens lighting the tips of trees, folded honeysuckle buds cupped like hands in prayer, holding only hope, burst open like tiny flames, flinging their fragrance through the damp air, then shrivel, leaving delicate pistils to ripen into fruit. I leave flowers, feathers, and heart stones with my daughter's ashes already blended into soil. I'm now 5 years past the age Grandma was the day of the vacuuming faux pas. I'm just starting to figure things out. My friends and I watch each other age, bespeckled and bespectacled, breasts amputated, hearts restarted, moles and wombs excised, eyes cloud, insight deepens, bellies soften, backs ache, hips and knees replaced. Still we march and teach, write, sing, do yoga, eat yogurt. Friends inflict photos of grandchildren. We're in pretty good shape for the shape we're in, one says. Now she is dead. Trees spend one-third of their lives dying. Throughout winter, brittle beech leaves cling fiercely, paling to lace, then wave like first flowers until spear-tipped buds, pointed like a calligrapher's brush, nudge them finally aside, unwrapping silky newborn skin as last year's leftover foliage melts into the moldering blanket, reticulate with microscopic lifelines, whose bodies fruit from those same disintegrating trees. The mostly rotted trunk of a majestic maple, older than my grandmother by several greats, houses red squirrels, bluebirds, and brown-eyed barred owls. A pileated woodpecker feeds on the feast of insects, in turn feasting on the tree's flesh. Yet one large limb, still green, still blossoms, releases gossamer wings, curling to the humus, fed from the deep loam of her own mulch, and by the invisible mycelial web nourishing offspring sprouting around her. I too am in my last third. I can answer some of my own questions. I know I'm never going to figure it all out. Every morning, the stranger in the mirror startles me. A slumped form and vaguely reptilian face peers back. Lines where none were yesterday. Spots and sags, loose, softly wrinkled hands like my grandmother's. The grandmother I will never be. Like the fading beauty of the withering leaves. This is called No Small Thing. A small bucket on my doorstep greeted me when I came home one gray late winter day. Inside, pale pastel heads closed tight against white plastic. A bundle of tulips lay wrapped like a delivery from a stork. Happy spring, love Catherine, written on a torn scrap, perhaps because she knew that Scout, my guide, my lifeline when Ellen died, had left her body and I was again lost in sorrow. Or perhaps because she works in a grocery store where flowers are, or perhaps because. Soon they unfolded, a surprising deep magenta, faint indigo stains, ringing center stamens, dripping black mascara, and every time I thought, this is it, this is their fullest beauty, they changed again. Translucent petals bent backward, twisted in dry spirals, holding their magical hue, now fragile in the splendor of old age, morning light leaking through those transcendent trinkets like tinged glass, casting pink shadows dancing on the floor. I kept them until every petal fell off, collected each papery purple feather to flutter over the rock with Ellen's ashes. Those flowers gave me so much joy. That is no small thing. Well, this is a more recent one. This is just to punctuate the intensity of some of those poems. It's a little irreverent. It's called Shabbat. Do you think God minds when I light the candles late? Sing the melody wrong, and know only one other blessing which I say when I plant seeds, but it's supposed to be for wine. Does God mind that I bake bread on the day of rest? Does it piss God off if I blow the candles out, though I can't imagine God wants my house burned down? How does God know what time it is anyway? And isn't God bigger than this earth, so our sunset is not seen from God's eye? Does it matter to God how we cover our heads, shape our breads, in which language we pray, what direction we face, what name we give her, or even if we believe at all? Is God what we call the magic of all we do not understand? Do we read God's mind as if it were our own? And why minds, if not to question and create? There's just a little problem here with my, this is a prose poem and I need to figure out how to see it. There we go. Okay. This is called Heartscape. And it was in response to a prompt to describe your internal landscape. I am the lake. The white-capped waves crashing wildly, and the quiet swells licking the island's lichened rocks. I am the islands nestled in solitude among the comfort of my own ebb and flow. I am the blueness of the bright sky kissing the greenness of the water's surface along the hem of horizon, that elusive space between day and night, sorrow and joy, love and pain. I am the hiding stars and path of moonlight into the dark. I am the seagulls gliding below the rim of surrounding mountains, little white clouds of grace. I am the minnows and rainbow trout, scales reflecting undulating ribbons of sunshine. I am the hope of tadpoles and frogs frolicking, insects within their flowery ecstasy. I am the spidery webs and wet grasses tucked tenaciously in contours of sinuous soil, collected in winding lines of centuries-old stones. I am the soil gratefully receiving the rain. I am the rain, the patter on dry sand releasing the earth's aroma and the storm. I am the uprooted pines, the songbirds keening for lost nests, the raging wind ripping seed heads from flowers. I am the seeds that wait. And just in case you might have tuned in late and didn't catch my poem Senescence, I am both a bereaved mother and a motherless daughter. So this poem is called Garden Vision, and it's all happening in my imagination. The setting is not my imagination. Garden Vision. The view from the back porch is serene. The lawn slopes down to my garden, surrounded by brilliant blobs of color. Round, ripe raspberries dangle like fat rubies, and undisturbed, below a wall of nettles, a marsh of cattails, willows, orange lilies, pink Joe pieweed, and an enormous cottonwood, arms swaying, each individual fluttering heart-shaped leaf returning the setting sun, thousands of hand mirrors waving. Caleb's head rests on my foot as his pillow. He runs in his dreams, perhaps chasing the baby robin I did not let him kill this morning. The porch isn't really a porch. There's a roof attached to the back wall of my barn, supported by 2x4s above a pallet floor, and though on this evening I can hear only the chorus of summer dusk, om of crickets, arias of cardinals and thrushes punctuated by occasional squirrels' rushed conversations and the shush of vibrating wings as emerald-backed hummingbirds drinking their fill of elixir hang like ornaments above bursting sprays of magenta bee balm, this paradise is not an island, but right in town, in between neighbors who, for the moment, are not home. This is the home that was always supposed to be temporary, that I was always been gonna leave someday. I have come to understand that won't happen. I have planted asparagus. Their lacy glazed plumes shimmer in dewy mornings, snowy feathers above a bed of bobbing red poppies. This is the home where Ellen lived her whole life, where I will live the rest of mine. As clouds turn to gold, Mom sits down beside me, looks out at the scene with a smile, rests her needlepoint on her lap. Does she have a cell phone? Yes, of course, she is practical. Her hair would be a fluffy white halo now, though we'd both enjoy telling how she used to have me balance on the edge of the tub behind her, while she'd peer into the mirror, ferreting intruding gray hairs for me to yank out, until she decided she'd rather go gray than bald. Her eyes still blue-green hazel. At least I think so. Did I ever know, or did I take knowing for granted? Ellen's lilting laughter in harmony with the tinkling wind chimes announces her arrival. Her phone accompanies her always, dings often as she joyfully lives her dreams. She is discreet about responding, knowing she might receive a reproachful scowl from me if she lets it interrupt too often. She leans toward me, kisses my cheek. Her eyes are deep, dark blue, like unfathomable pools, like the bottom of the ocean, like the velvet sky right after sunset as stars reappear before all the blueness completely fades to black. I reach up to hug her and kiss her back. Jonna, honey, Ellen says to her little one, holding tightly to her hand, do you want to pick raspberries? Together they race off to the edge of the yard without containers of any kind, running back a few moments later, brightest lipstick dripping. Ellen plops Jonna onto my lap, then swishes over to wrap an arm around her grandmother's shoulders. I behold my daughter and mother knowing each other, my arms folded around my granddaughter's imperceptible body. She nestles into me. I nuzzle her soft, miraculous hair. Their presence lingers on the scent of leftover lavender. Happiness interlacing sorrow overflows into the yard, cascading through this magical night, down my cheeks, floating on birdsong, up to iridescent clouds, blurry through wet lashes. Caleb cries in his sleep. I stroke his smooth fur, soothing us both. And I have one more. Thanks. This is called Wonder. It's short. Wonder. The way a swallow balances on a single swaying stalk. The way its bones are hollow and a yellow leaf wafts upward like a butterfly or skitters like a chipmunk across the forest floor and a tanager glows like a coal in the canopy. The way if you sit still long enough, letting yourself blend into the dark, you can follow firefly trails. The way some things you can only see from the corner of your eye, like the Pleiades, or rainbow light at the edges of clouds. The way sugar is made of sunshine and rain, and our bodies are exploded stars from thousands of millions of miles away. The way strawberries shimmer like jewels hidden below green leaves, and when cut open, their hearts bleed red like us, but oh so sweet. The way you still visit in my dreams, and when I awake, feel you here. Thank you. That's it for me.
Thank you, Naomi.
Thank you so much.
Such wonderful work. And you share painful situations. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Naomi, what unique perspectives or themes do you believe women bring to poetry, and how does your own writing reflect this?
I'm reluctant to generalize about women, because there are a lot of us, more than half of the population. I guess I prefer to speak about my own experience as a person identifying as a cis woman. So my perspective or perspectives as a woman would be as a mother primarily, and as a daughter, and I am still very much a mother, and in relationship with my daughter, and also very much my mother's daughter. And beyond that, I'm not sure about unique perspectives. You know, I write a lot about nature, but I think for every Mary Oliver, there's a Wendell Berry. So I'm not trying to sidestep, but I guess that's what comes to mind.
I believe that you bring you.
That is true.
To the proceedings. How do you feel about that?
I think that's very true. Yeah.
So when you bring yourself, what are you bringing?
I'm bringing a person who feels deeply, who thinks deeply. I guess most of all, I would say trying to, as you mentioned, take the pain of my experience and turn that into something of art, of meaning, of something more than just my own personal sorrow held inside.
Understand. So, what advice would you offer to aspiring women poets seeking to find their voice and share their stories through poetry?
Since I'm such a baby poet, I'm not sure what have I done? I've been persistent. I've been patient. I've trusted myself, and I've reached out for feedback and have been very grateful for the community of poets, especially online. And yeah, I think that people need to, for again, there are all these contradictory thoughts, because getting feedback can be a double-edged sword, and what one person loves, somebody else hates. And so ultimately you have to have your own inner compass and your own North Star, and follow that and be true to yourself. And I think that if you pursue your art, the rest ideally will follow. But I do think, because we live in a capitalist world, we have to jump through hoops, and there's this element of sales that's involved, and that I think that's where persistence comes in.
Right. Thank you
Thank
to
you.
your colleagues, Amanda, Mary Louise. Is there anything that you heard that you'd like to comment on?
Oh, I agree with the patience part. We need to be patient with ourselves and with the whole process.
Thank you. I think we may have time for one or two comments from someone else. Would anyone else like to share anything in the group, in terms of what you heard? Thanks again, Naomi. Our next poet is Mary Louise Kernan. Mary Louise.
Thank you, Dr. Ingram. And thanks to Naomi Beinman and Amanda Russell. And my gratitude to everyone who's listening now or who will be listening at a future date. My name is Mary Louise Kiernan, and I am zooming in from the Hudson Valley in the state of New York. I am a member of Calling All Poets, the Woodstock Poetry Society, and Cultivating Voices Live Poetry. Published by Kelsey Books, the title of my full-length debut poetry collection is The Gift of Glossophobia. The word glossophobia. Glosso is the Greek word for tongue, and phobia is fear. So it means the fear of speaking, the fear of public performance. And in my case, I've taken it a step further. And for me, it means the fear of voicing my own opinion. And the reason I call it a gift now is because if I had not been stricken by glossophobia at such an early age, I would not have written down many of the poems that are in my collection. So before I read my first poem, I want to share a little bit of a backstory on it. I was told that the poem I'm about to read was a make yourself feel good poem. I was advised to cut this poem for my manuscript. And then I came across Mary Oliver's poem, Don't Hesitate. And it was the last line that stayed with me and inspired me to rewrite the title and to keep this poem in my collection. Making the cut. Joy is not made to be a crumb. Mary Oliver. The air, a sea of creatures, horseflies and zigzagging birds, clipping, crisscross, glinting electric wires that skip rope with the sun. The scent of sappy evergreen engages my senses of seasons to come while I sip coffee iced and the sunlight simmers on my polished toes. Treasure the memory of this day against the underside of the fall before winters hurry to the door. Don't let the cold in, days for sure on their way. No, no one can steal this surge from me. to stop the bloodletting and to start my healing. Raising Sunflowers for Vincent Van Gogh. Now I think of you, mon cher Vincent, and how at 15 I fall head over like the seedy-faced sunflowers I grow for you by the walkway fence. Their feathered heads droop, and in their dieback phase of bloom hang heavy, each petal sensing sunflowers and dahlias that would caress your coffin. I imagine pleading with you in Auvergne, do not put that brush in your mouth, do not suck on that lead-laden paint, don't not eat, don't bed that prostitute. To your brother you write, la tristesse durera toujours. On my heart I poem, oui, my sadness will always last. So this is a prose poem, and it falls into the category of documentary poems. And what I did in this poem was to intertwine American history, family history, my own personal history. And just as an FYI, Rosa and Erna are my grandmother and my mother, respectively. In the year 2020, 24th of April, pandemic waves of death, anthem waves of grain, flag waves at half mast, 50,000 dead across our United States, 5,000 in the city of New York. Quote, victims of coronavirus die by slow suffocation, end quote. Need a mayor say more? CO of the Latin corona, VI of virus, the D of disease, COVID is coined. And the 19 for the year. The protocol, stay home to save lives. We hear, but do we heed? 100 years ago, the second wave of the Spanish influenza ebbs, 675,000 dead. A year earlier, 30-year-old Rosa gives birth at home to baby Erna. Newspapers read, how to prevent influenza? Stay home. 245 years ago, Patrick Henry's plea, give me liberty or give me death, delivered troops for war against tyranny. Today, so she can party hardy, a 20-something sign demands, give me liberty or give me COVID. Middle-aged passengers in sports utilities vehicles protest for their freedom from quarantine. In a Tiananmen moment, a lone American woman in hospital scrubs faces down self-appointed patriots. Then the leader of the free world cavalierly suggests his subjects ingest disinfectant. Conspirators troll, has the fearless one already gotten the vaccine? Daughter of Erna self-isolates 40 days. Biblical tale of Noah to save the believers 2 by 2. A daily virtual horoscope assures her that romance is in the air. She tightens her mouth before stepping out into the wind. Lucille Clifton wrote, somewhere in the unknown world, a yellow-eyed woman sits with her daughter quilting. My American store quilt. My store quilt outstretched across my car's hood. Another yard sale. Another letting go. Another home to pack up, releasing once again. When a young mother with two little ones claims her church is collecting blankets for victims of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, Louisiana. I'd hand-sewn bias tape to make loops to hang it, too perfect, too precious to use as a blanket. I think back to the summer day, I first held it, $100 saved to buy post-baby clothes. Instead, I turned back to the upscale shop in Bridgehampton, east of the Indian reservation. Stitched by Native American tribeswomen, a platinum saleswoman took pride in telling, wrapping it in layers of aqua tissue as if it might break. "Yes, please take it," I say to the young mother, a yellow-eyed woman teaching me my quilt was never mine to keep. I still miss that quilt. Oh, gosh. Connecting back to Hurricane Katrina, there is a female force, speaking of women's history, who deserves more respect and attention than she's been getting. And that would be Mother Nature, who's becoming less and less patient with us. And as an aside, I am grateful that the following sequence of haiku has been accepted into the forthcoming 25-year anniversary anthology of Calling All Poets. Mother Nature has her way. 1. Praying mantis kneels. Break dawn, mosquitoes quiver, coupling in midair. 2. Leaves cluster porch side, curled horseshoe crab shells on stems, matchless for wet wind. 3. Marble rain bombards, Gaia rages, ice sparks, fire cracks her thunder whip. So, Eleanor Roosevelt, I have this bookmark, and I use her words in my book also. You must do the thing you think you cannot do. So, based in Cork, Ireland, there's an Irish writing group, and they offer a weekly challenge. And it's a five-word challenge. And that particular week, the words were squirrel, twin, wait, ripe, and find. And it was part of the 11th O'Vail Five Words International Poetry Competition. I'd like to share the poem that I wrote as a result of what I was afraid to do. I didn't think I could do it, but I did it. A Tale for No Tale. A squirrel is a squirrel, you tell yourself, until you spy the one with no tail catapulting from limb to limb across the old twin-trunked tree. How could it have no tail? Caught in a snap trap with no way out but to chew it off? A tangle with another critter? No matter, there are chores, errands, work to do. Yet, you wait. This rodent races light. Could there be a pair? Do squirrels have twins? Triplets? Twin sheets getting ripe, finishing with the washings, you find no tail twining itself around a birch branch, seesawing. Its tail hair sought for fly fishing lures. Did someone yank the tail and run? In his shed, your uncle chopped tails of caught plump mice to collect bounty. For years, your no-tail springs up, down, around the tree. How long can a squirrel survive? Then you find a new home where your garden grows riper, riper. Pulling at weeds, you ignore two full-tailed gray squirrels. You search the word squirrel. Its roots sprout from scurus, skia for shadow, aura for tail. Greek word for a squirrel sits in the shadow of its tail. Once again, you recall the squirrel with no tail, only to ponder the why of why you wonder. And I will show you that I did give no tail a tail. Can you see? This poem is in the shape, so it's now an ekphrastic poem. And the astonishing news is that in the contest, my tale for No Tale has been shortlisted as one of 12 poems out of 480 submissions from 16 countries. So I'm happy for No Tale. I hope he's still squirreling around in that tree. Before I read my final poem, I just want to say thank you to Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram. He is an unsung hero in the world of poetry. He's done hundreds of audio interviews, and a year ago, December, he invited me to come on his show. And we talked about social justice. We talked about the craft of poetry, where your titles fit in. And I've listened to many of the podcasts, and they're like mini master classes with Professor Ingram there teaching and just encouraging writers. Because I am a glossophobiac, he was very extra kind to me, I think, although he is kind by nature. And I'm honored that he invited me back and said, bring along two poets. And I'm so happy that Naomi and Amanda have come along on this poetic journey. This next poem, my final poem, was first drafted a long time ago at an Omega Institute workshop led by the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Sharon Olds. And this poem became the winning entry in the adult poetry category for the Tempe Library Poetry 2015 writing contest, co-sponsored by Arizona State University. And now what they've done is they're doing an anniversary anthology. So I was contacted to say it's going to be reissued as part of the anniversary anthology. No dwelling. My high on the hill home must be multiply listed with no time to rue. I resolve myself like the persistent sparrow mourning its egg-filled nest knocked from above the front door cornice. Bewildered, the bird shuddered mid-air, its wings backpedaling furiously in place. How fast can a bird's heart beat before bursting? Quelling my own palpitations, I will mirror the ways of the winged one that rebuilt its nest, flight after flight, meshing leaves and twigs with mossy mud, then weaving in a single strand of my child's hair, loosened during a porchside hairbrushing. How fast can my own heart beat before soaring? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm your biggest fan. You know that.
And I am the president of your fan
club. Of my club. A different resonance in your voice. A year ago, in what areas do you feel that you've grown in terms of your craft since we were together?
It took me a long time to do any kind of public reading, and I actually worked with an acting coach. And the thing that stayed with me the most was he said, it's not about you. He said, it's about your work. He said, always honor your work. And that's what I try to focus on, not the fact that people are staring at me, which makes me uncomfortable. The backstory to that is one of the poems in my collection. So I think just valuing my work and getting, not that everyone needs a prize or an award, but I have to say the 2015 award from Arizona State University was absolutely life-changing for me. It gave me the confidence. And when I came back to New York, I applied to the New York State Writers Institute. And you submit work, and I was accepted. I was in a room of all 20-year-old MFA students. And by the end of the 2 weeks, I thought, you know what, my work is as good as theirs. And I was encouraged at that point by one of the professors, not necessarily to go on to get a master's degree, but to work on a full-length collection. And that was more valuable to me personally than getting an MFA degree. Little by little, by getting validation and by sharing my work and getting feedback. So that's how I have changed, and I'm so happy to be in my Act 3, and I had no idea it could be this good.
All right. I like that. Based on your lived experiences, what unique perspectives or themes do you believe women bring to poetry? And how does your own writing reflect this?
Like Naomi said, I can't really speak for other women, but I think the physical body of being a woman gives a different perspective. And I have a 25-word poem I can read that
Please.
I think is unique.
Please share it.
The title is Riptide, and it is in, comes out there in the shape, tide. Show me the poetry in pregnancy. Your placenta settled like a creature sunken, one heartbeat from hemorrhage. You, a tiny survivor, floated shut-eyed, suspended in love's riptide. And a man so far has not been able to have a baby. There are women who haven't had babies or people who've lost their babies. And I think that I was able to write this poem, and it's unique to me and my personal history. And I think what's important is that it doesn't matter what gender you are to read this poem. Someone who has the ability to be empathetic would be able to appreciate it. And in this case, I think the poem is unique to me.
What advice would you offer to aspiring women poets seeking to find their voice and share their stories through poetry?
Naomi brought up the topic of patience, and I think I've learned to be patient with myself. I would read when all the how to be a writer articles, you must write every day. Okay, I don't write like that. Okay, I think more about what I'm about to write, and when I know where I'm going, that's when I sit and write. But for aspiring women poets, I would say definitely take advantage of any free workshops you can go to, whether it's at a library or a community center or a community college. And in that MFA workshop group of people that I was involved with up at Skidmore College at New York State Writers Institute, we handed out our work, and we were not allowed to respond to any of the feedback. You made your notes or took in the notes that people made for you. And if you didn't communicate what you needed to do, there is no way you can just say, I meant to say X, Y, Z. For aspiring poets, I think just taking in the feedback and then deciding for yourself whether or not it's valid or not is very important. And my first poem was published at 40. In my 40s. But at the same time, every time I begin a poem, I am an aspiring poet. So I still am aspiring to be a poet.
Thank you very much, Amanda. Naomi, any thoughts for your colleague or your fellow poet?
I just want to add to what you just said. I love that, Mary Louise. It's like the Duke Ellington. You're only as good as your last gig. Yeah. So the process is ongoing.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's a continued growth. Any comments from any of the other members Participants, anyone who would like to share something? Our final poet today is another acclaimed poet. Her name is Amanda Russell. Amanda.
Hello. Hi. I'm so happy to be here. This has been wonderful to listen to Naomi and to listen to Mary Louise. So by way of introduction, I'm a stay-at-home mom and a guest editor for the Comstock Review. I have two poetry chapbooks. One is titled Barren Years, and it looks like this. And it was published in 2019. And then my forthcoming is called Processing. And this is the cover for it. I don't know if you guys can see that. It'll be coming out later this year from Main Street Rag. And I can be followed on Instagram at poet_Russell. That's two S's and two L's in Russell. And my website is poetrussell.wordpress.com. And I love to update it. So I'm always putting things up there, events and different things. So I'm going to start with reading some poems from Barren Years. I'm going to read the first poem in the book and then a few pages in. So this book, it covers a miscarriage that I had. I miscarried twins in the second trimester. And so it is a lot about the grieving process. It's a lot about relationships and communication. And so here's how it starts. It's called So Long. Unlike onions, perhaps some people don't grow to maturity all in one season. Maybe they share more with the clematis vine, its spurts of growth and decay, separated by periods of darkness. And yet, still others seem more kin to the sweet gum tree, who continuously grows up and out and down, alternating between stages of nakedness and fullness, and taking so long, so much care to grow. Another poem from Barren Years is Birdwatching. And this one it's a mixture of a dream, but also we lived in a duplex many years ago that had a giant tree in the backyard, but it was a very small yard. And so that's the setting for this. Birdwatching. The nest is empty. I watch the sweet gum tree. Check it regularly for signs of a new inhabitant. Last night, I dreamed of Bluebird. She swooped down, gathered and tucked and gathered and tucked for 3 days and nights, rebuilding a new nest inside the rotting, wind-blown, time-worn bowl to make it suitable for life once again. I was delighted to watch from my laundry room window, bending low and looking up as far as I could to spy her magic work. She brought together all things into one house of straw, of twigs, of dried up leaves. She filled it with love, with potential, and then with life. When I woke, they could not yet fly away. And I wondered, how would she handle that fulfillment? How would she let go? And go.
Mm.
And I'm going to stop from Barren Years now and switch to some of the newer poems in the forthcoming collection. So fast forward in my life, and I have two children. I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old. And I'm a stay-at-home mom, so I spend a lot of time alone, in a sense. Especially when the children are very young, it can be, we often feel very alone. This is called Lessons Learned by Trial or Error. When we said, I do, I didn't know you'd be away every day. never agreed to be poured out and refilled with another person. When the nurse said newborns tend to cough in the night, she failed to say and turn blue. I see you off to grad school each morning, then watch our daughter's life inch forward. But this living room is too small. My ambitions are responsible for the cracks in these walls. I know too well how an apple turns into a core of itself to drop its seeds. And not only because that's the image on her favorite page of the book she always picks to read. While she looks at that core, I whisper in her ear, there's a star inside. You see it when the apple is split just right. And this next one is, I was reading an article. I have one of my children, my son is on the autism spectrum, so it explains why I'm reading this article. But I was reading this article, and this poem is an ekphrastic of the graphic that was with the article. And it's probably still with the article. It's called Reading an Article from AMA Journal of Ethics titled Mothers and Autism, The Evolution of a Discourse of Blame. The drawing to the right of the title shows a mother with no face. Also shown is a child imaged from behind. Short hair, brown, yellow jacket. The angle drawn in the mother's chin suggests she is looking slightly down at the child. I imagine her eyes, noticing dark circles beneath the child's eyes or searching for whatever has been, again, lost. The mother's skin is empty of pigment, as is her hair, tucked behind a missing ear. I imagine her ears, listening longer than she thought she could, for the end of a sentence started 3 hours ago. I see her lips, hear the words she doesn't allow herself to say. I imagine pre-dawn air coming in and out of her nose, a subtle, undrawn sign of her own life. One of the things that has occurred in my life is that I have moved a lot. And when you move to a new place, you try to figure out what's going on there. You sign up for newsletters, you join groups, try to figure out where you can fit in this new place, in this new world, and how to get involved. Then there's the process once you move away, deciding whether to stay connected or not, and in what way. What newsletters do you, and email lists and et cetera, do you unsubscribe from, and what do you keep? And that is a little bit of background for this poem, Chasing the Goose. An email arrives from Bold, Nebraska. I no longer live in Nebraska and have never been Bold, but I do like to know when it's time to plant the sacred tonka corn. And if plans to build Keystone XL have finally been buried, and if Jane Cleave is a real person, because what would the world be like if every person were a real person? I want to tell you, there have been moments of joy. A year ago, I found a to-do list folded in the pocket of the vintage leather purse I carried when I lived in Nebraska, a time capsule from before I carried children. And the joy was not in finding the list, nor in being able to cross out any tasks accomplished, but rather in the fact that those things I had wanted to do were still things I wanted to do, and that I could, even now, step out this door, stand in the yard long enough to leave footprints, and admire the lone goose flying south, instinct etching its every arc, and trace its visage beyond the end of our dead-end street, wet hands pulling out the knot around my aproned waist, dishes left soaking in the sink. And This next poem, it's called In My Mansion, There Are Many Rooms. I'll just jump into it. Neighbors often witness me rolling up sleeves, my body stretched and split and stitched like some corporeal applique sewn around my role play. Dustpan fulls of unlived lives, compost the same as watermelon rinds. The sweet stuff, long scraped out with a shiny metal spoon, like a fetus who failed in utero. If you run your whitest gloves on my windowsill, years of Sunday sermons come undone, stirred up and weightless as petals at the feet of a waterless vase. Another lifetime will peel from the page and stutter out of your throat like a misremembered name. The wisdom of so many saints proved less convincing than the letter he penned me. Never mind what I said in the car about us. The absence of vows became a cloud I carried home between metal wings and a lightning rod with which I stirred the limiting reagent of faith until gray hairs cupped my face. Somehow it happened. She had become a part of me. A home I filled to my fingerprints. Not some hidden else, not even the exaggerated hand of motherhood now grasping the multifaceted jewel of my heart, but my own flash of light catching in my mirrored hall. This next poem is called Processing, and it is the title poem of the collection. It's a definition poem. I fell in love with the word processing and just the richness of it, and that is literally what inspired this poem. Processing. As in ongoing, fluxing, as in computing and hold please and etc., as in wait 600 minutes and the anchor we never dropped. And how carefully can a person jump out of a plane? As in, whatever you thought you saw, stand over here this time. Think again, shift, mend. As in, what didn't kill me, could have, may yet. As in, development, and just a minute, and who can tell me what is missing, went wrong, was right, is gone? As in, if you think the kitchen is dirty now, you should have seen it 30 minutes ago. I will answer when you finish speaking. As in, hello and goodbye, all rolled into one, maybe. As in, the way in never reveals the way out. So what should I do with this map? As in, unless I've misunderstood physics, the earth is always pushing back. And I've got two poems left. So this is the last one I'm going to read from Processing, that collection. It is a love poem and it is called Between Faded Blazes. And blazes here is not like a fire, but like blazes along a hiking trail. There are color-coded rectangles that are usually painted onto trees or rocks to let you know that you're still following the same trail. And so it just is a way to help hikers not get lost, but often they are in need of being repainted, or they are a little too far apart, or you don't see one as you're going along. Between Faded Blazes. Unless I scream it from this lookout, no one else would know. I cut the length of your hair to the exact width of my fingers. But we know some messages can only be carried with the hands. And so you cook me breakfast. I serve you dinner. You pack your lunch. I write blackberries on every grocery list. We are the muscle of careful intention and the bone of languages we are still learning to speak. We are a cautious step after step upon loose boards and fallen branches that have hugged themselves into a bridge. We edge woods and wetlands in hurricane season, one of us in front of the other, saying, "Watch these thorns slip over that board," exaggerating the movements of feet by overlifting the knees. And once in a while, or always, all around us, what a beautiful view. Thank you. And recently I took a class on writing Haiban, and this is from that. So I'm going to read a Haiban. It's called Fit. Shoving a showered arm through a crisp jean jacket, I rip the polybarb tag and head straight for the mirror. A perfect fit against my new neon pink V-neck. And 4 months later, we start again, 500 miles away. Dark green polo shirts, khaki pants, black socks, black shoes, all awkward as my eighth grade body. In the dim dressing rooms of stores, not even half stocked with uniforms this late in the year, I stare at the question. Ask mom to buy the right size or the right brand. We bow at the pool of currency, thirsty for our life. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Ingram, for having me and including me in this podcast. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much, Amanda. For me, the authenticity of your work is compelling and powerful.
Thank you.
I want to ask just a couple of questions, if that's okay. Based on your lived experiences as a woman, in what ways do you think gender influences the reception and interpretation of poetry written by women?
So I had some thoughts about this. And so I think it does play a role to a certain degree. And I think that's because we all have biases and we all have different perspectives that maybe we're not as open to. And the topics of poems and the experience that poets draw from or that readers are drawn to may vary due to the roles that gender typically plays in our society and in our culture. But I think that the more authentic we as poets can be in writing our poems, the more the poems will encompass and dive into the shared complexity of our human condition, rather than the experiences or topics that are limited by the differences of our genders and various particulars of our life. And I have an example for this. I was reading a poem. I have a few more things to say about it. I got excited about this question when I started doing some research and thinking about it. So I was thinking about, I recently read the book, The Human Line by Ellen Bass. And there's a poem in there that I loved. It's called Asking Directions in Paris. And briefly, like, the poem is about a speaker who's lost in France and trying to use what little French they know to ask for directions. The directions they're given are beyond their ability to comprehend. And the poem goes on to touch on deeper issues of being lost in the grand scheme of life. And I've never been in Paris. I've never been lost in Paris. And I don't need to be have ever been lost in Paris to appreciate the human experience of feeling groundlessly lost in my life. I think the poems that work best are the poems that bring connection. And they do that by tapping into that something deeper that abolishes our gap of all of our differences, our otherness. And then also I came across very recently, Camille Dungy did an interview with the Rumpus, and she had posted this quote on Instagram, and I said, "Can I please reference your quote?" She said, "Yes," and so I'm going to read her quote. She says, So for me to write about my experience because I'm a Black woman mother in the West, that makes me not aligned with the universality of the white male reader in the Northeast. But good literature crosses these membranes and barriers. Also, good readers allow themselves to be taken across these barriers. And I'm so glad that she posted that quote and that I was looking for it, because it just fit to just reiterate from another person that the same point that I'm hoping I'm making.
I've got to ask, were you destined to be a poet?
I have been writing for as long as I can remember. And I don't know, but I keep going. It's infinitely interesting to me, words and how to put them together and how to, there's a lot of things I don't have words for, and I want to have words for them, so I go after that.
So what advice would you offer to aspiring women poets seeking to find their voice and share their stories through poetry?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So I would just say, read widely, write as much as you can, go to open mics, listen to other poets, share your work, learn about revision, say yes to any opportunity that you're given, even if it's scary, maybe especially if it's scary, and try to meet it. Listen to comments that you get back from your people that you trust in your workshops, and surround yourself with people who support you and who want to see you grow, and learn to listen to the poem. There's a point when you're working on a poem where it'll talk back to you, and it'll tell you if you listen to it. And that's really important to learn. And then trust your voice, trust your reader, trust the process of writing. And I do want to share a quote by Rainer Maria Rilke in his Letters to a Young Poet that my high school theater teacher gave me, and I still have the copy. I read it often. But he says, try like some first human being to say and experience and love and lose. Seek those themes which your own everyday life offers you. Describe them with loving, quiet, humble sincerity. For to the Creator, there is no poverty. And I just go back to that all the time. I love that. So I wanted to share that for aspiring poets.
Thank you. Naomi, Mary Louise, any comments?
I'm just so moved and struck by Amanda and Mary Louise's work. It's so rich, so many lines just blow me away. And both of your work is so vivid and so full of life. I love, Amanda, the line about what would the world be like if every person were a real person? Yes! And Mary Louise, I think I'm so glad that you ignored whoever said not to put in the first poem you read about stopping the bloodletting and let the healing begin. I think I'm mangling it, but like, yes, that's I think a perfect example of trusting your own voice and intuition.
Mary Louise.
Oh, I remember the first time I met Amanda. We were up in New Paltz. It was Calling All Poets. And she read from her new book. And I did not have a book at that time. And I saw her reading and I thought, I want to be Amanda Russell when I grow up. She was just amazing. And I went out of my way to introduce myself to this rock star poet and said hello. I want to be where you are one day. And we became best friends from that point on. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. And that's how I learned of Naomi. I saw her amazing face and heard her totally honest, heartfelt words via Zoom. And yeah, so that's how we all connected.
Lenny, I thought I saw your hand raised.
I didn't raise my hand, but I will.
Okay, please.
I just want to say that this has been just a really comfortable, warm, and wonderful reading by all three of these poets. And I met them all through Zoom. I don't know any of them out in the real world, and I've seen them many times on Zoom, I believe mostly through CAPS. When I started going there, and I was just blown away by their work. And I think one of the words somebody said along the lines here was authentic. And all three of these women have such great authentic voices that are really compelling and really make you, really pull you in. And I'm just so glad I came today.
Fantastic. Thank you. Anyone else? Any comments? Guy, I see your hand.
Yeah, I would just chime in with what Lenny said and the authenticity. And I'm a little familiar with all three work. And I just wanted to say I really enjoyed this reading. It was really nice, especially on a cold, rainy day. And just felt a little cozy to sit here and listen. And I would just commend you guys for trusting your instincts, being brave in writing in terms of facing some of the challenges you've had. And it's really terrific. In terms of women writers, I don't know. I don't know if I picked up any of my books, if I didn't know if it was a man or a woman, if I'd, some I might be able to tell, others not. I don't know. I don't know. And I don't, if it speaks to me, it speaks to me. My top six poets, there's probably three men and three women. So I don't know. It's maybe there's more emotion. I don't know about more emotion. That's not, anyway, you guys were terrific today. Thank you.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you.
Anyone else before we close? In that case, I'd like to thank all three of you for joining me today. There were some hiccups initially as I learned how to do this on YouTube and Zoom. But other than that, it's a beautiful program. And like Lenny and Guy, once my anxiety died down and I was able to just sit here and listen, I felt so comfortable. And that's what poetry can do. It can bring a sense of comfort. It can bring a sense of a lot of things. But one of those things is comfort. Because although our lived experiences, our stories are different, there's a universality in terms of our feelings. There is. Naomi, were you going to say something?
Oh, I'm just agreeing with you about the universality of the human experience. I think what Guy was saying, if you just didn't see the poet's name and just read the work or heard the work. Yeah, I think that the work has to speak for itself.
Yes. Mary Louise, Amanda, any final comments before we end this poetic journey?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have tremendous gratitude for you. And it's been wonderful.
Yeah, it really is.
Such a pleasure.
It really is.
I Amanda, can't wait till we all meet together sometime.
We'll arrange a part two.
Yeah.
All right? We'll arrange a part two for later in the year. That's my goal. We're going to make it happen. Amanda, any final words from you?
Thank you. This has been wonderful. I didn't really know what it's what to gonna expect. Be like. And I was like, oh dear, we're gonna be asked questions. But this is really thank you so much. Yeah.
I can't think of three other poets that I would have wanted to be with me as we started this venture. So thank you. And thank you to everyone in the room. That's the end.
Still craving poetry? Hundreds of episodes of The Quintessential Listening, poetry, online, radio, and YouTube podcast are available to listen to or download on iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming platforms. To learn more about the popular podcast or how to become a guest, visit www.qlporyt.com. Till next time, take care and let poetry ring somewhere throughout the land.